So I'm basically the dictator of ggplot2, mostly benevolent, I think.
Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. That's qlik.de/datastories.
Hey everyone, Data Stories number 67. Hey Moritz, how's it going?
Good, good, good. How about you, Enrico? All fine?
Good, good. Stormy day today.
Stormy in New York. It's depressing and rainy in Germany.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Expected, right?
6 months of fall. No. Anyway, any news? What are you up to?
Well, teaching time here. Mm-hmm. So quite happy with my new version of the course. Uh-huh. I'm planning to write something about it soon, so hopefully sharing some ideas I have with the world.
Sounds good.
But mostly focusing on teaching because it's the start of the semester, mm-hmm, so that's mm-hmm. pretty normal. How about you? I saw some new stuff from your side.
Good, yeah. I mean, the year slowly kicking in, still like launching a few things from last year. So the last few days I was busy in launching Project Uko. It's a wind visualization about wind predictions. Quite nice. And yeah, it kept me busy. Like over the last year, it's a collaboration with Future Everything and scientists in Barcelona and at the Met office in England. And we look at how we can visualize seasonal wind forecast, like forecast for the next winter or a forecast for the next summer, how the wind will change. Probably it's a very probabilistic thing. It's all just playing with distributions and rough tendencies. Wind is very hard to predict, and the visualization tries to give you a sense of that and tries to highlight the spots where the most interesting developments are, so regions where we have a lot of wind to start with and strong changes.
So have you been working with statisticians?
Yeah, so the I don't know what the official job title is, but these are like climatologists probably, or like geo people. and they are really good with, of course, simulations and probabilistic models. And so the new thing about this prediction is that they actually have a physical forecast model that takes into account the physical state of the world, you know, at a given point in time, and then tries to extrapolate from that. And it's kind of crazy. Yeah.
So I was trying to induce you to talk about statisticians because we have a special statistician today on the show.
That didn't work out.
It didn't work out.
It was worth a try.
Yeah, well, I tried. So we have the creator of some hugely popular R libraries. So today we're going to talk about some of these libraries and R in general. He created ggplot2, one of the most popular data visualization tools in the world, as well as many other very interesting libraries. We have Hadley Wickham today on the show. Hey, Hadley, how are you?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good, good, good. Very, very happy to have you on the show. It was about time. So, I don't know how much we need to say about you, but normally what we do is we ask our guests to introduce themselves. Can you tell our listeners who you are, what you do, and and a little bit about your work?
Sure. So I'm Hadley Wickham. I'm the chief scientist at RStudio, which basically means I spend all my time developing stuff to make people more effective in R. So I'm broadly interested in data analysis, so how you can turn data into knowledge and understanding and insight, and the kind of the boundary between the human and the computer. So how can we like develop ways for people to think productively about the different parts of a data analysis, and then once they've figured out what they want to do, how can you efficiently turn that into code, and then how can that code go away and do the stuff that you wanted to?
Nice. So I think I would like to start directly from talking about ggplot2, because I mean, our podcast is mostly focused on visualization. And I think everyone knows, I think ggplot2 is one of the most popular things that you, that comes from your work. So can you briefly describe what ggplot2 is, just for the for those few listeners who don't know what it is? And and maybe you can tell us a little bit of the story behind the ggplot2.
So ggplot2 is an R package for plotting. But what's different about it is it's based on this idea of the grammar of graphics, which was originally proposed by Lee Wilkinson. And the thing that's special about the grammar of graphics is that it's about, instead of saying like here's like a list of charts or a typology of graphics, like this is a pie chart, this is a line chart, this is a double y-axis line chart, this is a line chart with a bar chart.
As you would have in Excel, right?
Exactly. So instead of just having this list, which is, you know, which is great if the one chart you want to create is on that list, your life is easy. But if the thing you want to do isn't on that list, you're completely stuck. So the idea of the grammar of graphics is, instead of giving this list of things, to give all these little small components that can be combined, you know, pretty independently to create many different types of graphs. So the idea is, if you use ggplot2, you're not limited to all the types of graphics that have come before, but you can kind of create variations that are specifically tailored for the challenge you're trying to solve.
So can you tell us a little bit about how everything started? So how old is ggplot2?
I'm going to have to look that up because I always like forget.
A few years, right?
It's quite old now. I'm just going to look it up because it's probably going to disturb me how long I've been working on this for. But let's just look it up. Here we go. The first version, the first version went to CRAN in 2007.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that is 9 years. I think ggplot, not ggplot2, was around for a year or two before that. So
I'm totally ignorant about that. What's the difference between ggplot and ggplot2?
So it's actually, it's a really interesting question. So the thing, basically the ideas are exactly the same. But in ggplot, I was really into functional programming at the time. And so the way you created more complex graphics was by composing functions. So in ggplot, you layered things together by composing functions. In ggplot2, I overrode the addition operator. So you made complex graphics by adding things together. The thing that's kind of interesting is that I've recently come the full circle, which with dplyr, which is basically a grammar for data manipulation, it also works by the way you compose together multiple steps is by composing functions.
But you pipe them, huh?
Exactly. But I discovered that in R, R is flexible enough, you can actually write an operator that kind of allows you to change the order of things so you get the nice properties of function composition, but it's easy to read in the way that ggplot2's sort of addition is. So if I discovered the pipe, you know, back then there never would have been a ggplot2. It just would have been ggplot, which is nice because that then it would work seamlessly with all of my other packages that I've been writing recently.
Okay.
Yeah, it's sort of the same logic people might be familiar with when coming from JavaScript, like jQuery or D3 use that quite a bit, that you would do a couple of function calls in sequence, and each function call passes on the result to the next. And it's funny because it's a very natural model of describing what should happen in sequence. But I think it's only been popular for last few years, really, except for the Unix pipes, right? Where you would do that on the command line. But all other programming languages wouldn't really use that the type of pattern.
Huh? Well, I'm sure Smalltalk did it.
Yeah.
So how did you decide to create ggplot2?
It mostly sort of came out of frustration, which is mostly driven by
good stuff. Yeah, it's a good start. Yeah,
like drives 90% of my software development.
I used to use
Lattice, which is that was kind of the main plotting package in R at the time, which came out of the work by Bill Cleveland on the Trellis graphics, and like it was a lot better than the. So R is like many different plotting systems. The simplest is base graphics, which is basically, you know, like draw a line here, draw a bar here, draw some points here. And then Lattice was built on top of that to support this idea of trellising, where you want to do different plot. You want to do the same plot, basically, for different subsets of your data. And I just, I used it and I got quite good at it. But there were things that just seemed like way too hard. Like there's some types of legends that were really difficult to do. And then there's just the sort of like inelegance that you could call like XY plot, which would normally do a scatter plot, but you could change one of the arguments and make it do a box and whisker plot. And that just sort of seemed like so theoretically unappealing to me. And it's sort of about that time I was also reading Lee's book on the grammar of graphics, and that I sort of, the thing at the time was, if you wanted to actually use the grammar of graphics, the only way to do it was to buy some like insanely expensive, like, you know, $40,000 or something, software system. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this seems like it could be a fun project for my PhD to try and do this in R. So,
yeah. And the grammar of graphics has been developed by Leland Wilkinson, right? What, in the 80s or something like that?
Yeah, I think the early 90s, I think.
Oh, early 90s. Okay. Yeah. So, and I mean, ggplot2 is used, I guess, by a ridiculous amount of people. I don't know if you have any estimate from your side. And I'm pretty sure that you have some interesting stories behind it. I mean, I guess you've been observing to some extent what people do or did with ggplot2. So do you have any interesting stories about that, or particularly interesting, I don't know, success stories or visualizations that... I don't know, add interesting outcomes or something like that.
I don't know. Now my kind of theory is that like your statistics package or your visualization package isn't successful until it's been used to allegedly commit scientific fraud. So I kind of like, if you go to Michael Lacour's homepage, it just has like the most beautiful ggplot2 graphics on it. I'm like, wow, that's kind of cool, and it's kind of terrible.
That looks pretty good. But,
yeah. So I mean, I think that is, you know, one of the downsides of visualization, right? That you can make things that are very, very aesthetically appealing and kind of emotionally compelling, and then that maybe people are less critical of them than they would be of, you know, very ugly charts. But I mean, the thing I love about ggplot2 is kind of not the big like things that, you know, like things in the New York Times or whatever. It's the people that are using it to like solve some like weird, like the tiny problem in their scientific domain, which like I have absolutely no interest in. There's probably like, you know, 30 people in the entire world who care about it, but they care about it really passionately. Yeah. And I don't know, I just really like that sort of enabling these people to understand what's going on with their data. Another story that I have that I just found out about, I'm going to Melbourne next week to visit Di Cook, who's my PhD advisor, and now at Monash. There's going to be a conference. The conference is called Wombat. Which I think might be a clever acronym, but it's about visualization and understanding data. But Di found, we're going to go to a cafe because she found that the cafe is a blog and they use ggplot2 to understand their sales and stuff. So I just think that's like really fun and really exciting. So I like to sort of talk to people who have just got little small scale problems, but, you know, in aggregate, people are doing lots and lots of really interesting stuff with ggplot2.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's one of these tools you can recommend because it seems, I don't use it really, but it seems to have sane defaults, because every like ggplot2 plot I see seems to look okay at least. So,
yeah.
Right? And so did you put a lot of work into the defaults, or did you just try and keep it minimal and just avoid any basic mistakes? What was your approach there?
The defaults, I think I spent quite a lot, like defaults are really, really hard because you can't have one default that's right for every situation.
Right.
But I think it's really, really important. And I think the other thing is, one of the things that draw people to use ggplot2 initially is because just like the basic plots are aesthetically pleasing. Like you get like kind of a, you know, a decent looking plot right off the bat without you having to do anything. And you get that experience before you kind of, you learn any of the benefits of ggplot2 having this deep underlying theory. So that was very deliberate. And people don't always agree with my aesthetic choices, particularly the gray background with the white grid lines. But
I love that. I do it all the time myself.
Me too.
The one benefit that I really like is that a default ggplot2 plot is very visually distinctive.
Yeah,
so I can spot it easily.
Yeah,
there's some branding aspect almost to it.
Exactly.
Which seems like, you know, it's very minimal, but there is some sort of brand to it, which is interesting. Not that many libraries have it that strongly. Yeah.
And even recently, there's some, I think, like some new visualization packages that kind of like cargo culting it by like copying the gray background and white grid lines, which is also,
it's,
you know,
that's
flattering. So I'll choose to take that as a compliment.
No, but I think it's interesting to see that there are quite a few. When I think about successful data visualization solutions out there, you always find solutions that are somewhat aesthetically pleasing, that have some sensible defaults, but at the same time, they allow a lot of flexibility if you need it, right? So I'm thinking about D3 as well, which of course is very flexible, but also has a lot of really, really good defaults, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Tableau, which of course is much less flexible, but still some degree of flexibility, and the defaults are amazing as well.
Yeah.
So this seems to be a very, very good formula for visualization. So, but I really want to get an opinion from you about what do you think distinguishes between libraries or tools in visualizations that are successful and widely adopted from those that just die after a while. So do you think there is some kind of, I mean, I guess it's a lot of factors, right? But if you would have to pick a few factors, if you had to suggest to a person how to create a successful data visualization library or tool, what would be the first, say, two or three factors?
I think there's sort of something like really important about the ecosystem in which your visualization system is embedded. Sort of my experience is really like often, like once you've got the right data in the right format, aggregated in the right way, the right visualization just kind of happens. Like in many cases, like the visualizations is the very, very end of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And once everything else lines up, often that visualization just, you know, happens pretty naturally. Or even if it requires some struggle, it's nothing compared to the struggle of the rest of the pipeline. So, and I think you can sort of see that in my work too. You know, I started off in visualization, and over time I've just expanded my scope to kind of include more and more and more of that data pipeline. So I think, and you know, and that's where I think D3 is successful, because, you know, lots and lots of people are using JavaScript. There's lots of ways of getting your data into JavaScript, and Mike's done some projects as well with cross filters, sort of in browser database stuff. Tableau, you know, has invested huge amounts of money making sure wherever the data lives in your organization, you can suck it out. I mean, those are the things that I think kind of, like, ironically, the success of a visualization project is all about the non-visualization stuff. It's like getting the data to the right place. Because if you can't do that, you're kind of dead before you can even begin.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, I think another aspect is also being able to build a community around the tool itself.
Yeah.
Because I've seen so many tools that every time you choose to invest in a new tool, you are running the risk that this tool is not going to be there in a few months or years, right?
Yeah.
So being able to build a community around it means that you can ask to people, whenever you have a problem, you can ask to a large community of people, right? And again, I think this is true in your case, it's true with D3 and so on, right? But I guess it's also a huge amount of work. I mean, it's not just that you code something up and then it's done.
Yeah.
I guess it's really a lot of work, right?
Yeah, well, you could see like 10 years. I've been working on ggplot2 for 10 years. And you know, I think the other thing is it takes a long time to get momentum. And it's sort of funny because the other reason that ggplot2 exists is because at the time there were like, you know, 100 people using ggplot, which I was like, oh my God, 100 people are using my package. That's incredible. And so I didn't want to break their code. And so that's why I made like a completely new package instead of replacing the old one. And the irony is now that like I do a release and I make the tiniest change, like, or even if it's fixing a bug, but now there are like 200 people who relied on that bug. And mm-hmm. It's just that.
Are they starting to complain because you're fixing it or?
Yeah, I guess some of the, it's just it's hard. Like I look at ggplot2 and I see like, this clearly doesn't work right. Don't use that. Like, yeah. This thing that's a bit weird. That parameter seems unusual, and so I just never use those bits. But of course, no one else has that insight into ggplot2, and they use all these bits, which I think are ill-advised. And then I break them because I break their code by doing what to me is improving ggplot2. Uh-huh. So that's kind of the price. It's also a little, you know, ggplot2 sort of had about a 2-year hiatus when I was working on other problems. And, you know, people sort of complained that like nothing was happening, but the downside is when things start happening again, then I will like, things start breaking in your code, which, you know, that's, I don't know. There's I think people generally undervalue stability.
Yeah,
like things aren't improving, but there are known workarounds and people know how to deal with it. But when I start kind of developing again, even if it's fixing bugs, that inevitably causes problems for someone else. So it's always sort of like a trade-off, like how trapped do you get in kind of design mistakes that you made a long time ago and lots of people rely on, but you think a bad idea now. It's and that's sort of a challenge of doing software development when you've got a lot of users.
I mean, how do you manage that process? Is it like, are you, let's say, the lead developer for ggplot2 or the only developer? Do people come to you with requests and you make a decision what to include or not? And how does that usually work? We also had one question from Gaming Dude on Twitter, if there are any specific ggplot feature requests that you just will refuse out of principle, things like this. So there's some curiosity how it works. And I'm curious too.
Yeah. So I'm basically the dictator of ggplot2, mostly benevolent. Mostly benevolent.
It's a valid model for many projects, I think. Yeah.
And you know, ggplot2 is very stable at this point. So there are only kind of small stuff going on. Most of the feature tracking goes via GitHub. So people will submit issues if they find a bug or want something new. And you know, while I wasn't working on ggplot2 for a long time, those issues kind of accumulated. And at one point, I just declared GitHub issue bankruptcy and basically closed every single one of them with an apology.
Everything's resolved, don't worry.
Yes, which actually turned out, I think, to be the right thing to do. Because when I came back to it, it just wasn't this overwhelming wall of problems. I could just pick, you know, a few small things and get traction on them.
I
tend to be... What I'm trying to do recently is try to be as realistic as possible. So if the chance of me ever fixing this is small, I'm just going to close it right away and say, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'll review a pull request if you want to do that, but otherwise, no. I mean, you know, there are some things that I would like that I will categorically like never allow in ggplot2, like double, like multiple y-axes. I think that's a really, really bad idea. So there's no way that'll ever happen. But you know, most of the requests are things like I don't have any problem with. I just don't feel any passion for them. So I'm like, well, if you want to do that, you can do that. But I'm not going to. I think one thing that has been really that I should have done a long time ago is that the latest version of ggplot2 has a extension mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So you can now people can write their own packages that build on top of ggplot2 and add their own geoms and their own stats and stuff. And that has been, I should have done that. There's just been like an explosion of people creating these neat extensions, like things that I would like, you know, I think they're really cool, but I would never have the time to do them. There's actually now, there's even a web, someone's now made a website too. Let's see if I can find that quickly. But let me, it's really
like
cool.
Like a repository for all the, or a directory of all the extensions that are around?
Yeah, exactly. It's ggplot2-exts.github.io.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good idea. That puts a lot of like of these specific requests from your shoulders, right? At the same time, you have to keep it more stable than your own API and can't just like...
Exactly. Yeah.
So exactly. It's only for very mature projects, I guess, to make that transition. Yeah. I'd like to move it a bit to the general R ecosystem, the discussion. So how is it? Like, let's say somebody says, that sounds all really good. I'd like to use ggplot2. Do you have to use R? Like, is... It only works inside R, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically you're buying R with, or it's free, but you have to sort of get started in R in order to use ggplot2, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about R for those people who don't really know? I mean, you know, many will have heard of it, but maybe people didn't really check it out yet. So what is R?
R is a statistical programming language, which was written by John Chambers and others at Bell Labs, which is really designed as kind of a statistical glue language. This was in the era where, you know, all your computations were done in Fortran and C, and you just needed something to kind of, you know, string the output of one routine to the input of the next one. And that was the vision for ES. R was, and ES was basically, you know, owned by Bell Labs, and they kind of commercialized it. And then R was an open source kind of derivative. It shares a lot of the same. It's very, very similar to S as a language. There's a few important differences. That was written by Ross E. Harker and Robert Gentleman at the University of Auckland in the early mid-80s, I think. I forget the exact times. But.
Wow.
So R is like a language that's designed for statisticians and people interested in data. It is definitely quite different to other programming languages that you might have used, and definitely has its quirks. But I very, very strongly believe that, like, at the heart, R is like a very beautiful and well-designed language that's very well-equipped to deal with the problems that you encounter when you're trying to work with data. And I think because of that and just the rise of the importance of data, the popularity of R has been skyrocketing in recent years. So, you know, depending on which of the programming languages rankings that you believe, and some of them I really don't believe, like the IEEE has one where it ranked like R as like the 9th most popular programming language, which I would kind of love to believe, but it seems implausible.
Yeah.
But it's definitely in like the top 20 programming languages, which is still kind of mind blowing for me for a language that, you know, 10 years ago was a very specialized language that only people with PhDs in statistics used. And now it's, you know, it's everywhere. Every, you know, Google has thousands of people using R, Facebook has hundreds, is, you know, Twitter, Uber, every tech startup you can think of has people using R.
Yeah.
It's used in
New
all
York
the sciences.
New York Times uses it extensively.
Exactly.
Amanda Cox is a huge R fan, of course. And
Yeah, it's incredible.
And how would you say, like, for, let's say, the R, both the environment, but also the community, like, how would you characterize that as opposed to, let's say, other types of communities? For which type of people will this be the right thing, like, in your feeling? So it's a language for statistical computing, right? Do you feel you have to know statistics well? Like, what all the statistics terms mean? Like, is everything very technical in description? Or do you feel it's also okay for designers who want to get more into data analysis?
I think, like, at one level, you know, it is fairly technical. There's a lot of things that only statisticians will care about. But on the other hand, and people will probably laugh at me, like, for saying this, but it's also like PHP. Like, it has everything in the kitchen sink in it.
Right. Which, and you find a lot of snippets you can just copy and run, and whatever they do the right thing somehow, and you can move on, right?
Exactly. And you don't have to become like an expert in programming languages to understand what's going on. You can kind of piece it together on your own. And I think that's kind of really powerful. And there's now a lot, you know, Stack Overflow has lots of answers, and there are lots of people all over the place who are willing to answer your R questions.
Right.
Yeah, I think what is really interesting, I mean, the way I use R is pretty, pretty basic. But most of the time, I think one of the most powerful aspects for me is that it's so easy to load a new data set and start playing with it, right?
Yeah.
I think this all
interaction loop where you write a statement and maybe it's wrong, but you write the next one because now you know how to fix it, right?
Yeah.
And another aspect that is amazing, every single time I use R and I get stuck into something, I search something in Google and here we go. I mean, I just, honestly, I mean, I don't even have to understand the statement. I just use it, right? And that's unbelievable. I think it's an amazing characteristic.
Mm-hmm. So it's a step-by-step, trying something out, see what happens, try the next thing, and that keeps you going, basically.
Yeah, because when you think about what kind of tools exist out there for just data manipulation, they are either too rigid or you need too much programming, right?
Yeah.
So I think R is very much in between where you can, as I said, you load a data set and you kind of start playing with it, right? And and you have the summary function, for instance, that gives you an overview of what are the attributes in your table, what's their distribution, and so on, right? And it's just one single statement, super, super easy, right? And and so on. So I think it is very powerful for visualization, but even more powerful, the more powerful aspect from my point of view is data manipulation, and it's very, very much needed.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that I spent a lot of my time on that last year, just making sure it was as easy as possible. You know, if your data is in Excel or SAS or XML or JSON or whatever, just making sure you can get that into R as easily and as painlessly as possible. Because if you can't get your data in, then you can't do anything. It doesn't matter how awesome the rest of the stuff is.
Yeah, and a lot of your recent packages focus on data reshaping and data massaging and aggregation, you know, and this let's have a big table, but let's slice it up in different ways and merge columns. You know, these types of things we do as we explore data or, as you say, prepare it for a data visualization.
Yeah.
How do you pronounce it? Is it Plier or dplyr?
Dplyr is the modern one, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think to me, like, it's TidyR that's the more interesting, because TidyR basically, like, this is a philosophy. This is how you should store your data. And the principle is really obvious, and it kind of sort of astounds me. It took me like 6 years to figure this out. But the principle is you put your variables in the columns and you put your observations in the rows.
That's brilliant.
and that's basically...
No, but it really helps. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's basically like COD's third normal form expressed in sort of statistical language. But like once you have that, like that's like how you should store your data. And then it's also like how should people design APIs to work with data in R? Because once you've got that consistent way of like variables always look like this and observations always look like this, it's much, much easier to design tools that, you know, where you're not like trying to ram the output of this function into the input of this other function and... just so everything goes. So my goal is so that you focus on the data analysis. You're not like eventually the R, your fingers just kind of like type R code without you thinking about it, just flows out of your fingers. It's just completely like subconscious. And, you know, and I accept that that's still a long way away for most people. But at least like there are problems like that happen for me where the R code kind of flows out of my fingers and everything just works. And you know that happens for me now, like after more than 10 years of programming in R, and you know, writing lots and lots of packages. So one cool thing I did yesterday, which everything just lined up and worked, was I did a visualization of every place I visited in the United States by looking at my TripIt data. Do you guys know about TripIt?
Yep.
Yeah. Really
nice. So you basically, TripIt's this cool service, you just forward them all of your receipts and then they generate like an itinerary and build up your calendar and everything. It's really awesome. And it turns out they have and I've been using that for like 8 years or something.
Oh, nice.
And it turns out they have an API, and that API uses OAuth, which is an R package you can talk to. And then you can pull that down and then that gives you this sort of nested tree. And then recently I've been working on this PER package, which in this context basically makes it easy to turn trees into data frames. Then you do a little bit of data manipulation on that, and then you plot it with ggplot2, and then pretty easily, pretty quickly, you get a plot of everywhere I've been in the US. And it just like, and that took me like, you know, 45 minutes to do, which is pretty cool, I think. And it, I don't know, like, it just, when everything lines up like that, it's still admittedly unusual for me. So I realize that for most R users, that does not happen very frequently. But like, that's what I want bot to be happen, that everything just flows. It works mm-hmm. kind of naturally. You might have to learn a few new ideas, like this idea of tidy R, of variables and columns, observations and rows. But once you've got that idea, like the code is much easier to write.
This is a good time to take a little break and talk about our sponsor this week. So once again, Data Stories is brought to you by Qlik, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Qlik Sense, which you can download for free at qlik.de/datastories. And one good reason to download Qlik Sense right now is to take part in the Qlik Open Data Challenge. And the winning data viz created with ClickSense would earn $10,000. So I think that could be good reason to participate. And the idea is to use free public data from datacatalogs.org on issues such as the environment, population, education, health, to create an app in ClickSense that not only analyzes this data, but also inspires people to take action. I love these contests because you see so many different solutions to the same basic challenge, right? So for instance, last year's winners showed the human impact on the planet, talked about adoption in Brazil. There was a school navigator for Italy. So all kinds of interesting things. And that really shows how much you can do with public data and how much you can learn about the world and how we can inspire people to take action on important issues. And again, if you win, it pays really well, the first three prizes, and that might be an extra motivation to put in a few hours into that. And in addition, of course, it's a great way to get started with a new tool you might not have as much experience with, such as ClickSense. So check it out. The link is in the show notes, and we are really looking forward to see what the submissions are. And yeah, thanks so much again to Qlik for sponsoring us, and back to the show.
So many people are interested in learning R from scratch. So do you have any suggestions for people who wants to start, but maybe are a little intimidated? They don't have a lot of programming background or even zero programming background. What do you suggest?
I think like the meta suggestion for learning anything is always to find like something that you're passionate about and interested in. And then like, don't just say like, I want to learn R. So there's this problem I want to solve using R. I think that's a great way to get in. I'm also working on a book called R for Data Science with Garrett Grohlmond. Like all of my recent books, that's available for free online. So you can actually see me write it. So I think if you, it's just rfords.had.co.nz. It's still, there's some really good chapters, and there are some chapters that have like three sentences in them. But I think it's this is what we're trying to do. Like these are the packages that we think, these are the things you should know, the packages you should learn that are going to make you as effective as possible, as quickly as possible when you're doing data analysis or data science with R.
So are there any, say, tutorials or...
Yeah, then there's lots of other great online stuff. The Johns Hopkins folks have a Coursera course that a lot of people have found really helpful. DataCamp is a new company. They have online tutorials for R with videos. You have to pay for them, but they're generally pretty high quality. There's a neat R package called Swirl. So Swirl actually tries to teach you R inside of R, by giving you this kind of little interactive exercises and then checking your results.
I used that. That was quite nice because it takes you by the hand and it's very easy. And so I had a good start with that. Yeah.
Those are the things that, I mean, there's also just like so many books now, and the books are like getting really like specialized. So like, you know, if you're in, it's like R for forestry science and R for fisheries and, you know, anything that you can name, there's a book about using R for it. And then, you know, heaps of good tutorials on the web.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd like to come back to this idea of like all these packages, how they come together. It seems like you have a certain philosophy or a certain idea about data and how to best work with it. And then all these packages, they follow that paradigm. And once you understand your basic way of thinking, it all ideally falls into place, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
exactly.
So you have a certain idea of how to make tools, and then each tool you can easily pick up, and it's a hammer, it's a screwdriver, but you know, it's a Hadley hammer and a Hadley screwdriver. Yep. So you have an idea of. So can you tell us more about tool making? Probably you thought a lot about that, like, and how it's different from other activities or academia also, and so on. Yeah.
I mean, I do find out, like, when someone asks me, like, what I do for a job, like, just in that ordinary context, I'm like, well, I don't really do anything. I, like, make tools that other people use to do data science.
Right.
Like,
it's very meta, it's sort of
a,
right?
Yeah. It's a, you know, I do a little bit of data science, but mostly what I spend my time is building tools. And I don't know, like, a lot of it, I think one of the things that's interesting is, like, this, like, there's things that I know and I can do really well, but I can't describe what I know or how I do it. And like this tidy data idea, for like a very long time, I could look at a data set and say, do this, do that, and do this other thing, and it's going to be much easier to work with. But I could not tell you like what principle I was following. Mm-hmm. And so when I like tried to like start teaching this at Rice, I was like, well, this isn't very satisfying if I can do it and I know there's like some underlying principle, but I can't explain it. So, I spent a lot of time thinking about that. And so there are like some sort of like simple things that I can tell you about, consistency is really important, like figuring out how to be so that everything, like once you've learned one example, that you can generalize that to, mm-hmm. to new cases. I mean, there's sort of like this, like making, you know, a lot of my work is like these grammars, or where you provide like little building blocks, where mm-hmm. each building block is simple, you can easily understand it in isolation, and then the way you deal with complex problems by chaining lots and lots of these little problems, little things together. And, I spend a surprising amount of time just like trying to think of good names for things. Like naming things is really, really hard. But
especially
it's so important.
Software packages, because people have to type it over and over again. So the name, if you come up with like a stupid name, it's going to bite you really bad. Yeah.
And one of the, like, I think the things, the sort of testimonials that I both most enjoyed about dplyr was someone tweeted to me how they were showing their dplyr code to their PhD advisor, who has never programmed in R, and their PhD advisor could actually understand what the code did.
That's great.
That like expressing yourself in code, I think, is code as a communication medium is a really, really important thing. And it's, you know, it's hard, but it's sort of a worthwhile struggle.
And it's sort of interesting because, I mean, in a way you are designing a product. I mean, it's an open source product and it's a software, like a library product, so it's a bit different than maybe what you would think of as a product in the first place. At the end of the day, it's a product, and you make all these decisions about the communication around it, the branding, as you say, how it actually works, how big it becomes or how small it stays, and so on. And so you do that now at RStudio. What is RStudio? Mm-hmm. Is it a company? Is it a club? Or is it, what is it exactly? I just know it's a software product you can download and use it to interact with R, right?
Yeah, so RStudio is a company. We have kind of two main products. The IDE, which you can both kind of download and use on your computer, or you can run from a server. And then we also have Shiny Server, which allows you to make or serve up Shiny apps, which are just a way of basically turning, instead of creating a static PDF report, you make an interactive web app to show off the results of your analysis. So RStudio is, you know, an open source company, which means, you know, our goal is to do as much as possible in the open, and then find the, you know, small percentage of features that big companies are willing to pay a lot of money for and charge a lot of money for those features. I think that to me, like, our commercial products sort of are around solving two problems. So the first problem is, like, you've now got a team of like 5 or 10 or 20 people are all using R to work on problems together. How do you make that team of people as productive as possible?
Right.
And then the other problem is, like, you've done this fantastic visualization or report or Shiny app on your computer. How do you then push it out to the people who actually need to see that? How do you solve the sort of last mile of data analysis problem?
Yep.
And, you know, that's working pretty well for the company so far. So, you know, I joined our studio because I'm sort of passionate about the vision. The goal of our studio is not to make money. Mm-hmm. The goal of our studio is to make great software for the R community and, you know, as hopefully a happy coincidence, make money as well.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the goal is not to optimize income. It's to optimize mm-hmm. kind mm-hmm. of awesomeness. So I don't know. I'm really excited about R Studio as a company and working there, and it's fantastic.
So Hadley, so if I understand Shiny a little bit, that's also a way to introduce some degree of interaction
exactly.
in R and ggplot, right? So can you tell us a little bit more about what is your view on interaction and how much of a limitation it is in R and ggplot
yeah.
too.
Yeah, interaction is sort of interesting and challenging because there's like so many different levels of interaction. Because at some level, like to me, R is an interactive environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. Yeah, yeah. It's not that if you are typing when you type something, you are actually interacting with it.
Yeah. So I think there are some things that are like difficult to express in code. Mm-hmm. Like when you look at a plot and you see a point and you're like, that is a weird point. Yeah, I want to find out more
exactly.
information
yeah.
about
yeah.
it.
You want a tool
it's
tip,
very,
right?
very natural to yeah. like, you know, you want to touch it. You want to say this point is the one I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Right.
But to express that in code, you're like, well, X has to be greater than this and Y has to be less than that. And that's very, very, so there are things that are very like, that are difficult to express in code. Or then the other sort of thing is like, you're designing a, like, you know, you want a label to be here instead of here.
Yeah.
There are some things that just feel so natural. You want to like directly interact with them and drag them and move them around the screen.
Right.
Or,
it's
you
the
know,
Brett Victor dream, right? That you do something directly on the representation. It feeds back into the code and you can
exactly.
sort of go back and forth. Yeah.
So
it's hard.
Still,
it's really hard.
we're sort of, I think, just sort of still dipping our toes in the water there. There's a cool new R Studio feature called, and Shiny feature called Gadgets and Add-ins, which traditionally, which is funny to say about Shiny, which has only been around for a couple of years, but you know, most Shiny apps
in the old times.
Are used to communicate to like non-analysts. So the type of interactivity you provide is basically you say, well, instead of giving you this 200-page report, I'm going to give you like three drop-downs and two check boxes, which would allow you to generate anything in that report. Mm-hmm. So mostly Shiny apps are used, you know, the data analyst, the data scientist creates them and then a non-expert uses them. And it gives them sort of some like a constrained environment to explore where you can't do everything, but you can do the things that you're most interested in. The things that's really interesting about gadgets is that they kind of sort of flip that around. They've got like in a gadget, a Shiny gadget is a tool that a data scientist uses or a data analyst uses. So you call it like a regular R function, but it pops up an interactive window in R Studio. And the thing that's sort of, I think, particularly innovative about these is that you can interact with that. So you can select that point. And then what the gadget will do is it can like return an object to R. It could return like mm-hmm. a vector of trues and falses, which you can then compute on. Or it could actually generate the code for you and then kind of insert that into your R console. Because mm-hmm. like one of the challenges of interactivity is like, how do you capture what you did so you can replay it again in the future? And I think we're going to see like, so this like this idea that there are some things that are hard to express in code, but you want to express them in code so you can capture what you did. So instead of you writing that code, have the, you know, you interact with the data and then the computer generates the code for you. And maybe it's kind of long and ugly, but that's fine because you didn't have to write it, but at least you've captured mm-hmm. what you've done. So I think we're going to see a lot of sort of innovation in that space. And again, it's for like these little, somehow like not like when you sort of look at like InfoViz projects, it's like their interaction is like everything. It spreads throughout the and that can be incredibly powerful, right? Because you can do all of these things so naturally and flexibly, and iteration speed is so small. But you're in like a closed system, and if you want to do something, the outside of that you just cannot escape. Whereas I think like interactivity in R is going to be like lots and lots of little interactive pieces where you call upon an interactive tool to solve a specific challenge. And then that kind of feeds back code or R objects into your workflow. And then you continue on. So you have this sort of mix of writing code where that's most natural and then interacting with the data directly where that's most natural.
Okay. So is it currently possible to just use R and create something that is interactive right away?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's basically what, I mean, the other way of looking at Shiny is as a way of like very quickly creating web apps. If you don't know anything about HTML or JavaScript or CSS, you can use Shiny to put something together pretty simply that gives you this basic interaction. And then we have these HTML widgets, which are basically kind of wrappers around common JavaScript libraries. So for example, there's like a leaflet. Leaflet is a JavaScript package for drawing maps. There's a leaflet R package, which lets you do anything you can do with leaflet, but it's all wrapped up in R code with an interface that's natural for R users. So if you know how to use R, you can now very easily create these beautiful drag and drop maps. And I don't know, that it just makes everything so easy. I think it's sort of getting to the point where even if you know quite a bit of JavaScript and a little bit of R, it's actually easier to do it in R because just all of the sort of infrastructure is like wrapped up in a convenient way. And I guess that's kind of like another, like coming back to the question about making successful, you know, software, successful visualization tools, is like thinking about that sort of infrastructure, like just getting everything installed and working, that can be a huge pain too. And like investing time in that so everything just kind of works, regardless of who's running it on what crazy system. Like that's really painful and annoying work, and it takes a long time to track down all these subtle bugs. But just giving people a tool that they can, you know, use and deploy reliably and instantly, that's incredibly powerful too.
That's true. I mean, if all these parts go together by design, that can make a huge difference. And yeah, I do a lot of web development, so I know exactly what you're talking about. NPM and so on.
Yes.
I think we need to wrap up soon, but I'd like to come to a few listener questions. So we had a few comments from Twitter, and maybe that also leads to a few like thoughts on the future. So we had two people. Thomas Pedersen asked, is a gram of interactions, is it doable? And Sven Erik Schelhorn also asked, after grammar of graphics, which was GG, and data plier, will there be maybe a grammar of models based on Kuhn's carrot package? Whatever that is, probably you know. So first observation is, of course, people expect a few more like grammar-based packages from you. So they seem to like the general idea, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, and I think people do like this idea of like, you know, little components that you can join together. You know, you're not locked into my vision of what you should be able to do, I think is very powerful. I mean, a grammar of interactions, I think, is totally possible. Jeff here and his student, Arvind Satyanarayan, had a really nice paper in InfoViz, I think, last year or the year before last. I mean, the key idea, I think, is functional reactive programming, which is a kind of idea that came out of the functional programming community, which is all about, you know, functional programming, if you're really hardcore about it, it's all about eliminating side effects. But basically all of visualization is a side effect. So the functional programming community came up with some sort of interesting tools to kind of get around that make it easy to reason about. So this idea of functional reactive programming is a way of effectively kind of declaratively specifying how things should change. And this sort of is how Shiny works too. You effectively have like a graph of components, and when one component changes, it does the minimal amount of recomputation to update everything else. So I think Arvind and Jeff have a really nice paper about that. I think that's like, that just seems like such a natural way to attack this problem, because it gets you out of all this kind of I mean, the phrase is callback hell. We've just got things calling back, and you just can't reason about what's going on, and you get these subtle bugs that if you do this and that, and then the other thing it breaks, but if you do it in a different order, it's okay, and it's a nightmare. So I that is something I want to work on for GGViz, which is the successor to GGPot 2 that I'm spending a lot of time on this year.
But would that be mostly like a software refactor, or would it be like, because the question was for grammar of models or interactions, do you think it would apply there? Like, do you think it could work well to structure grammar of models like this? Yeah.
So I think this will apply for a grammar of interactions. Mm-hmm. A grammar of models is a little different. And something, and I don't really have a good grasp on what a grammar of models is going to look like. I think it's really important, but I'm not quite sure yet how it's going to work. But basically the idea is, you know, it's like visualizations, right? You have this huge, like this, I mean, basically we're currently in this place where we have a typology of models, right? There's a list of models. Like, do you want a linear model? Mm-hmm. Do you want a generalized linear model? Do you want an elastic network? Do you want a lasso? Do you want a random forest? Do you want this? Do you want that?
Yeah, it's like a pie chart, line chart, or a bar graph.
Exactly.
So it's the same situation again, right?
Exactly.
So I can see the thinking,
yeah. Mm. Yeah, so that seems like there's got to be some way of maybe not for every single model, but for a useful subset of all models, putting that into a grammar so you can build up a model as you go from simple pieces. I don't know. I think my feeling is that the statistical theory isn't quite there yet, that there isn't the sort of overarching theory that lets you do inference on all these different problems. But that is something that I would like to work on, although it's unlikely to be for a year or two yet. But I think that's, like, when you look at what I haven't done, and that's kind of one of the few things I haven't even touched in the slightest. So but it's just a big project, and it requires a lot of like maths, which I don't have, and I'm not particularly
sure. Seems like a big challenge. I'm just reminded of Donald Knuth's books. Like, he's like at book, I don't know, 4 or something.
Yes.
Out of 7. So maybe you're now starting package number 3, grammar number 3. It might be a lifelong process, right?
I mean, I think it will be, but hopefully I won't have to retire and then keep working for like another 20 years and still only be halfway there. But
so, Hadley, before we wrap up, can you give us a glimpse of the near or far future? So what's coming up next?
So next, basically, I'm going to be working on dplyr. There's just a whole lot of bugs and a few minor stuff that I want to finish off. I've been also sort of thinking through this problem of like, you know, often when you start fitting models, you end up with a whole bunch of models.
Yeah.
And so how do you kind of keep them together and organize them and store them? And I now think it's pretty natural to put them in a data frame. So I'm just like slowly considering all the implications of that. And then once that's done, which will hopefully be about a month's work, the rest of the year I'm going to be spending on GGViz. And that, I think, that's going to kind of explode into lots of, there's going to be like GGStat, which is high-performance C++ implementations of common statistical transformations you want for visualization. There'll be GGGeom, which is like a data structure for dealing with the geometric objects that underlie visualizations, and efficient C++ code for manipulating them. And then GGLayout, which is some way of sort of thinking about how you lay graphs out, and an efficient C++ implementation for laying them out. And then, sort of thinking more about how the JavaScript works, and do we need like other backends and other, because one of the big things with GGViz, one of the big unsolved questions is that, you know, doing graphics in the web browser is awesome until you want to stick them in your PDF paper. So there needs to be some way of also turning GGViz graphics into static graphics that you can put on a website or put in a paper. And just thinking through that, how that's going to work is quite a big problem. But I think I have at least in my head, I have sort of a vague strategy. I know I've forgotten lots of important things where I'm going to be like, oh, wow, that's like totally not going to work. But I think I can push through those, and you know, I'll have like 8 months to work on it this year. So that's what I'm going to be working on, and I'm just gonna, a whole lot of other projects will just drift into a state of benign neglect while I work on that. So
So I think it's clear you always have a few balls in the air and you're just juggling a lot of projects. But it's amazing like what you were able to put out, and also I think the impact it had. We like to talk about impact and how...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, how the things we do change the world or not. And I think in your case, you did have quite a bit of impact, and that's great. And yeah, we're looking forward to following... all the new packages coming out. I'll try and do more R. It's one of the things I look forward
New Year
to,
resolution.
To dabbling with. Yeah, for sure. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been super amazing.
You're welcome. And thanks very much for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Adley. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, we have a request. If you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be extremely helpful for the show. I also want to give you some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We are, of course, on Twitter at twitter.com/datastories. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/datastoriespodcast. And we now also have a newsletter. So if you want to get news directly into your inbox, go to our homepage, datastory.es, and look for the link that you find on the right. One last thing I want to tell you is that we love to get in touch with our listeners, especially if you want to suggest way to improve the show, amazing people you want us to invite, or projects you want us to talk about. So do get in touch with us. That's all for now. See you next time. Thanks for listening to Data Stories. Data Stories is brought to you by Click, who allows you to explore the hidden relationships within your data that lead to meaningful insights. Let your instincts lead the way to create personalized visualizations and dynamic dashboards with Click Sense, which you can download for free at click.de/datastories. That's Q-L-I-K.de/datastories.